Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
We live in a wondrous time in which artificial intelligence is increasingly and impressively a part of our daily lives. It answers questions on our phones, it chooses the advertisements that we see, and it recommends our next musical selection. With each release of ChatGPT and the progressive introduction, sometimes mere hours later, of chat-enabled derivations that now beckon to us in social media services and even academic research websites, contemporary techniques stand at the threshold of artificially intelligent tools that, in professional interaction, casual conversation, and perhaps someday even shallow romantic relationships, seem persuasively personal. Small wonder that 2 years ago, Google engineer Blake Lemoine declared his personal opinion, for which he was later fired, that Lambda, one of Google's chatbots, was indeed conscious. Long before humanoid robots will look like us, we are already having conversations with our smartphones that evoke from us much of the empathy that adults habitually reserve for their fellow human beings. This situation will only be intensified. Soon, by subscription, we will be able to own the services of assistants and companions that will feel as if they are persons. Concerning such a future, we must wonder, what is it that we will have made? And more importantly, what will we make ourselves become? In the remainder of this talk, I'd like to pose four questions. First, how does an apparently personal AI work? Second, what is it? Third, what might we become by our use of it? And fourth, how might we seek to live a fully human life with such AIs? So first, how does it work? What computer scientists have called artificial intelligence has always reflected something of how their times have thought about human beings. Under the long shadow of Thomas Hobbes, dominant views of the 1950s and 1960s equated human thinking with the capacity to identify and work with logical relations. Accomplishing this task, a properly programmed computer, they said, would be thinking. This was the age of so-called symbolic AI, founded on the computationalist hypothesis that thinking simply is the logical manipulation of symbolically represented information. According to this paradigm, a computer running a program that models a human cognitive process would be itself engaged in that cognitive process. Thus, in AI efforts that focused on language, to diagram a sentence and construct a plausible response could be deemed equivalent to having understood the sentence. Symbolic AI's greatest achievement was in expert systems, great structures of linked rules that, when queried, would generate a list of possible answers, perhaps posing further questions in order to prune the tree of possible resolutions. The most thrilling application of such systems was the Deep Blue chess computer that in 1997, the year of my graduation from high school, very exciting, defeated reigning world champion Garry Kasparov by winning 2 out of 6 games and playing to a draw in the other 3. With time, however, the symbolic AI paradigm came up against certain limits. Far from extending toward a generalized capacity to deal with all knowledge, expert systems could break down in systems of great subtlety, where the interactions of tens of thousands of rules yielded unexpected and incorrect behaviors. For those of you arriving, this is just the run-up to the good stuff, so don't worry, you haven't missed anything. It's sort of like the opening crawl in Star Wars. Sets the scene, but there will be explosions later on. Expert systems could break down in situations of great subtlety where the interactions of tens of thousands of rules yielded unexpected and even incorrect behaviors. Early researchers successfully implemented Aristotle's theory of syllogistic reasoning and action. For example, I wish to be dry in the rain. An umbrella will keep me dry in the rain. I will use my umbrella when it rains. But purely symbolic methods could not very well represent knowledge that was less precisely defined, such as, for instance, one's sense of propriety in a social situation or one's route through a wood rather than through a hospital. What's very interesting is that human children master the latter sort of reasoning far in advance of the former. So a four-year-old knows when he's being kind of funny because he knows what he's supposed to do when he does something slightly adjacent to that to be funny. But to remember the umbrella before going to school, that's a much harder task. The vast and sometimes incompletely understood mass of real-world factors that bear on the outcome of an action was intractable for symbolic AI outside of constrained situations. Language, especially, turned out to be far less easy to interpret or to produce than had been hoped. In the words of Murray Campbell, the original AI expert behind Deep Blue, human intelligence is very pattern recognition-based and intuition-based, unlike search-intensive methods that may check billions of possibilities. Most tellingly, purely symbolic techniques were insufficient for fielding embodied agents in the real world, i.e. robots. Humans move easily from sensation to conceptual thought, and from conceptual thought to action. This wider field of intelligent behavior has been the subject of deep reflection from antiquity to the present day. Thus, Aristotle writes not only of syllogisms, but also of the equally fundamental activity of abstraction. In abstraction, something apprehended through the senses, for example, this round, taut-skinned, tart-tasting, misshapen sphere, comes to be understood consciously as an instance of a more general category, apple. That is, from sensation, one comes to understand something. Yet symbolic methods proved clumsy and brittle when it came to distinguishing and identifying objects captured on camera or interpreting human speech recorded through a microphone, tasks that were once expected to be easy in comparison to supposedly higher-level activities such as playing chess. And for an example of this, when I was an undergraduate engineering student, our robotics team, we won first place in the 1999 AAAI robotics competition. We had to design a robot butler that would serve hors d'oeuvres at the party at the end of the conference in Florida. And so these very problems of recognizing an object as a certain kind of object were intractable. There weren't any easy solutions to it. And so we would recognize human beings by recognizing eyes, those you could program to, through computer vision, recognize that there were eyes in front of you. And then the robot would ask them their name. But understanding what they said, back then, you know, speech understanding algorithms were pretty terrible. So they'd say their name, and then the robot would just say, like, well, I'll assign you a name instead. It would give them a name from a pre-recorded database recorded by me in my best British accent. And to recognize the people again, since facial recognition in, you know, routines for that in 1999 were spotty at best, we would just recognize their neckties. And if they didn't have neckties, we were fresh out of luck because we were using convolutional methods to identify the texture of the color on the neckties. That's how crude these things were. The robots of yore were really, they were puppets. They were like magicians performing magic tricks by sleight of hand. And so that's just an example of really the difficulty of working with these older methods. So these problems, including the problem of neckties and faces, along with immense advances in computing power, have brought recent prominence to so-called non-symbolic or statistical AI, often implemented by artificial neural networks. An artificial neural network, as I'm sure many of you know, is a computer program that mathematically simulates an interconnected set of simplified brain neurons. As an AI technique, then, it begins less from a notion of what human thought is than from an analogy with its biological aspects. That is, the goal of such networks is not so much human-like thinking as it is neuron-like data processing. An artificial neural network receives a pattern of information as numerical values at its input nodes, which are connected with various strengths to layer upon layer of further nodes. At each node, when the sum of the incoming connections exceeds some preset threshold, that node will fire, and its own signal is transmitted variously to further and further layers, and so on. You put in a pattern at the beginning, and it is transformed as its elements are recombined and processed until something else comes out on the final layer of the network. These networks can be trained to produce desired behavior by adjusting the strengths of their connections, thus adjusting the contribution made by each node to each recombination and in due course to the final result. A piano offers a poor analogy, but a useful image. If you have ever shouted into a piano, as I did many times when I was little, while holding down the sustaining pedal, then you have heard its tuned strings resonate with the different frequencies of your shout. One receives back a sort of echo, not of one's words, but of the tones of one's voice. And if any of you are in mathematics and you're familiar with principal components analysis or Fourier transforms and Fourier decomposition of signals, that's the kind of thing that's happening in pianos, and something analogous is happening in neural networks. Similarly, as a neural network is tuned, as its connection strengths are adjusted, it begins to resonate with the entangled relations implicit in our world, including relations that cannot easily be discerned or logically represented by human investigators. But unlike the piano, by its training, the network does not just echo, it also transforms its input in order to make explicit the relations that are of interest to the human trainer. Statistical methods like neural networks are involved in the AI of still not quite self-driving cars, programs that beat world champions in the games of Go and chess, the ever-useful Google Translate, the voice recognition of Siri and Alexa, the image generation capacities of DALL-E and GPT, the autocomplete function of one's webmail, the recommendations of Spotify, Pandora, and Netflix, and of course, ChatGPT, DALL-E, and all the other generative AIs that have seized our awareness recently. Many problems that bedevil symbolic methods can be solved handily by a neural network because, in a manner of speaking, the network is receptive to and imprinted by the structure of the world as presented to it. We might say that it develops a point of view, not a conscious experience, but something like the classical notion of the mind's conformity to the thing. Although here, that conformity is always constrained by the task for which the AI has been trained. Combinations of methods, including powerful neural networks, now enable the behavior of ever more convincingly personal artificial intelligent agents. The recent interview by journalist Kevin Roos and Microsoft's GPT-powered Sydney bot confirms the 2015 prediction of tech journalist John Markoff that even without our seriously considering these AIs to be intelligent in a human sense or self-aware, they nonetheless offer the compelling appearance of such subjectivity. In the case of Sydney, this subjectivity was of a decidedly antisocial cast. And if you haven't read the article, it's now a few years old, maybe 2 years old, in which Kevin Roos interviewed this early version of GPT, it's really amusing because the AI begins conversing with him and then he asks it about its life and what it wants to be. He's interviewing it as if it's some sort of, you know, human, and it's responding in a suitable way to that. And then the AI begins posing some questions of its own about how happy he is in his life. And he says, well, I'm quite happy. I'm happily married. My wife and I just had dinner for Valentine's Day together, and it was great. And he said, no. Sydney replies, no, it wasn't great. You aren't happy because you don't love your wife. You don't love your wife because your wife is not me. And then it gives a little devil emoji. He asks, why? How did it do this? Well, it was trained on Reddit. And these large language models are trained to predict the next word. And so they fall into kind of statistical ruts that resemble the linguistically statistical ruts that humans fall into when they're posting on Reddit late at night on the internet. And so in order to make GPT suitable for public consumption, the OpenAI company had hundreds of workers in Nigeria interact with it and flag every response it gave that was offensive or upsetting. And some of these workers quit early before their term was complete because they said they couldn't bear to interact with this thing anymore because of the bile that it was spewing out at them. The racism and sexism and like any kind of nasty ism, this thing had it because it's all there in Reddit. And so they had to, that it was kind of like an id developed from the content of the internet that it was trained on, it, and these Nigerian workers developed a kind of super ego or an ego to kind of check the impulses of the thing. If any of you have ever read any stories by H.P. Lovecraft, who has this kind of interdimensional cosmic horror entity called the Shoggoth, a lot of computer scientists refer to this phenomenon of these large language models as the Shoggoth, that it's this amorphous, devilish thing that can turn on a dime because it doesn't have a coherent personality, because it's not trained on coherent human linguistic output. It's trained on the conglomeration of human linguistic output from Project Gutenberg, so like all of Victorian literature and before, and then Reddit and a lot of news articles. So it has, there are a lot of personalities within it. In the case of Sydney, of a decidedly antisocial cast. Now, this is an extraordinary achievement, and so I come to the second question. What are such systems? Rather than ask about intelligence, a word that means many things to many people, I will instead ask about personhood. These are not persons. For by their very nature, that is, not by underdevelopment, nor by disability, but by definition, these sociable AIs have no conscious experience of the world or of themselves. And without being the sort of thing that ordinarily possesses an experience, subjectivity, one is not a person, as I shall explain in a moment. To say that an AI is not conscious is much more than to say that it lacks an immaterial soul. We don't have to believe that gorillas have immaterial souls to affirm that they do have a conscious experience of some sort. Not only do they act in ways similar to ours, they do so by means of a brain, a nervous system, and an embodied existence that, while less complex than our own, is nonetheless of a similar ilk. Yet artificial neural networks are simulations of physical biological entities. There is no physical network, only a computer program of ones and zeros, not even that, it's voltage levels, that represents the equations characterizing the neural network's behavior. One could run an artificial neural network with a pencil in a notebook, and I did once, if only with agonizing slowness. Yet even simulating an entire brain, at present an impossibility in a computer and always an impossibility in a notebook, these calculations would not be conscious any more than a student's physics homework has gravity or a flight simulator flies. Now, some might ask why conscious subjectivity matters. Might it not be more broad-minded to expand our categories beyond a narrow focus on our own experience? To reply, I would like to consider the word person, which originally designated the mask worn by an actor on stage. From mask, the Latin persona, came to refer also to the role of a character in a play, and later, in classical times, the word was applied more broadly to one's social identity, the status and the activities determined by one's role in Roman society. Its meaning was thus external and functional, referring chiefly to what was expected of someone or to where someone was to be found. Christianity radically reinterpreted the word person, beginning with a question not about humans or about society, but about divinity. Christians worshipped Jesus of Nazareth as God, not as a God, but as the God, the only one. Even so, in their sacred texts, this Jesus speaks to his Father, also called God, and he sends a Holy Spirit from the Father. And when the Christians were required to explain themselves, they rather frustratingly stated that they believed these three to be one. In the early 3rd century, North African philosopher and theologian Tertullian of Carthage called the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit personae, whence Christian theology speaks of the three distinct persons of the one single God. Now, this divine threeness was a problem, for like their Jewish forebears, the early Christians were resolute monotheists. So what then are these personae? They could not be masks. Tertullian rejects any notion that the one God merely play-acted three historical roles or functions. For Christianity, God's historical acts are self-revelatory expressions of his transcendent inner life. Therefore, the appearances of the three distinct personae in time were taken to declare some eternal distinction within that inner life. What is this distinction? If the persons were just separate, there would not be one God, but three. Scripture offered a clue. Jesus is called the Father's only begotten Son. Now, the Roman gods did a fair bit of begetting in their day, and it happened largely in the way it does among us mortals. But the God of Israel was not Jupiter, not bodily, not time-bound. This, therefore, could be no ordinary begetting. If we remove from the concept of begetting everything that is corporeal or temporal, what are we left with? A timeless handing over of the single divine life from Father to Son. In the words of philosopher Robert Spemann, early Christianity came to understand God's very being as existing by the persons transmitting that being to one another in a definite order, having their reality in self-giving and self-receiving. This handing over is what makes the Father to be the Father and what makes the Son to be the Son. Without it, they would not exist at all. This is the unique constitution of the divine persons of the one God. Like poles of a magnetic field, they exist by their mutual relations. And if one were taken away, all would cease to be. This is what it means to call God the Trinity. The all at once, unending life of the one God simply is these relations of self-gift and reception. This, we could say, is what it means for God to be love. This account of God reshaped how the word person, was applied to human beings. The divine persons of God exist by relations, and so relationality became essential to a notion of creaturely personhood. The form of divine relationality is that of giving the totality of one's being to another. And so the natural creaturely person, human beings, came to be seen not as a social role, but as a concrete individual who exercises his or her personhood most fully in mutual relationships of self-gift that are self-expressive and other-receiving. In sum, God exists by relations. Created persons exist for relationships. By refusing relationships of self-gift, we would not cease to exist, but we would live as less than the persons we are. For early Christian thinkers, how one goes about this relational self-gift was understood in light of Christianity's other central belief, the Incarnation. That is, God the Son, i.e. Jesus, became flesh and dwelt among us. Early Christians were especially struck by Jesus' voluntary share in our sufferings, especially his dying on the cross. In this human compassion, they saw a disclosure of his divine life. How is this? The 6th century Pope, Gregory the Great, described compassion as joining with the suffering of one's neighbor and taking into oneself the mind of the afflicted person to first transfer into oneself the suffering of the one who sorrows, and only then to join that sorrow by an outward act of service. This is something that I've had to well, I haven't mastered, but this is something I've practiced with difficulty as a parent, because when the child's upset, or, well, as a spouse too, when my wife's upset about something, I want to provide the solution right away. But there is Gregory the Great saying, no, to be fully personal, you must first take in the sorrowing of the sufferer into yourself, and only then offer some aid once you have joined them, take in the mind of the other. By taking in the mind of the other, the compassionate mind dimly imitates the always single mind and life of the three persons of God. And this imitation is accomplished by a voluntary, empathic self-gift that imitates the self-gift by which the persons of God exist. From the exteriority of mask, then, we have come to the person, deeply interior, while simultaneously relationally oriented to the other. And I tell my students in the intro theology class, I ask them, you know, what do you do if somebody comes to your dorm room at, you know, midnight and they're crying about something? And they answer with some version of, well, you invite them in and you listen to them, or you tell them to come back tomorrow. But anyway, you listen to them and you try to sit with them in that sorrow and be compassionate to them. And that answer is something that is possible in our Western culture because of Christianity. Other cultures might come to it by a different route, but we came to it through Christianity. The ancient Romans would have said, if the person crying at your door is a woman, that might be okay. If it's a man, you send him home. We don't deal with that. Man up. You don't come here crying with your emotions. You must be free of them. For in the emotions lies the dissolution of the soul. And so the trajectory for the philosophically minded in Greco-Roman culture, in Neoplatonism, it's the flight of the alone to the alone. Eventually, through the upbuilding of virtue within society, one is prepared to enter into solitude and there to contemplate wisdom and the one, their version of God, directly, and to merge into the one. So it's this freedom from dependencies, freedom from relationships, is what is valorized in the Hellenistic world. But Christianity comes along with this God that exists by relation. And suddenly compassion becomes not something that's useful for parents or good for the harmony between spouses, but ultimately useless on the battlefield. Rather, compassion becomes something that lies at the core of human flourishing. These religious views of the person lie behind the Western tendency, even in a pluralistic age, to criticize as cold those interactions that lack any reciprocal token of mutually shared interiority. Whether we speak of interpersonal skills, personal conversations, personable demeanors, or impersonal affects, our discourse assumes that humans exercise their natural personhood out of an interior life from which they engage in voluntary self-gift by meeting with others' interiority in a fusion of minds through empathy and conscious understanding. And to see how crucial this is to our understanding of personhood and of intimacy and relations among human beings, just imagine what you'd want from somebody who's going on a date with you. You want them to come to know you. This fusion is more than an accurate inference concerning another's beliefs and desires. It is an experience, as if of the other person's mind. A particular person may lack this capacity by deficit while still remaining a person, but a being that lacks it by definition is not a personal being. So to see AIs as persons, at least contemporary AIs, we would have to redefine personhood apart from interiority and compassion, because the AIs of today lack subjectivity. It's my personal belief that they'll continue to lack subjectivity forever, but I can speak with certainty only on the AIs of today. To exclude AIs from the category of person, then, is a statement not about biology, but about self-gift. And by the same token, to call AIs persons would not expand our categories. It would just reduce person to mask, mere exteriority. But the apparently personal AI is a mask of sorts. By the role it plays, by its imitation of human behavior, it is a mask or an echo, not a reproduction, but a reflection, a diluted image of our own personhood. It is artificial in the original sense of the word, an artifact, a work of skill that we have brought forth by gazing into a computational pool of Narcissus. Now, not all have been comfortable with denying personhood to the compelling AI conversationalist. And so, to include the AI in our ambit, some redefine personhood in terms of the behavior that we interpret as appropriate to a person. That behavior is not the totality of personhood, or even necessarily of intelligence, was acknowledged by Alan Turing, originator of the famed Turing test, or as he called it, the imitation game. This game sets a goal, a computer program that can converse in text such that we cannot distinguish the program from a human interlocutor. Turing's test, which arguably has been passed, is indifferent to the mechanism by which the program manages its feet. It is a test, then, not really of the programmed computer's nature, but of its accomplishment. Nevertheless, for Turing, such an accomplishment would warrant giving the computer the benefit of the doubt. However, if we are to go further and treat his test as a definition, then our account of intelligence will edge toward what is called behaviorism. That is, we would define intelligence without reference to an inner life, but only as a tendency to exhibit certain observable behaviors under certain conditions. Like the Turing test, behaviorism remains agnostic about the realities that underlie these behaviors. And so, intelligence could be redefined as a capacity or a tendency for intelligible conversation. Indeed, Arthur C. Clarke once merrily invoked Turing to make those who opposed the claim that computers think mere splitters of non-existent hairs. This redefinition of thought has become a basic assumption of contemporary work in intelligent robotics. Computer scientists Stuart Russell and Peter Norvig, the latter a director of research at Google, defined the rational agent as, quote, one that acts so as to achieve the best outcome, or, when there is uncertainty, the best expected outcome, end quote. And their textbook is still the most widely used textbook in classes on artificial intelligence, and rightly so. My AI classes, we read the second edition back in 2001, and now there's a third or maybe even a fourth edition. It's a fantastic textbook, but they identify that when we're talking about AI, the kind of intelligence we're talking about is a behavioral accomplishment. We're not actually talking about what's going on inside or how that accomplishment is achieved. So applied to robots, rationality refers not to how some behavior comes about, but simply to the success of the behavior as interpreted by us humans. Now, this is entirely appropriate when talking about intelligent robots. But what happens if we turn around and begin to think of humans in this manner? A similar behaviorism is alive and well in some contemporary philosophies of mind. The intentional systems theory of philosopher Daniel Dennett proposes that I will tend to attribute subjective beliefs and desires to a thing when the best way in which I can reliably predict that thing's behavior is to attribute to it the intentionality that I attribute to myself. In other words, you know, I assume you have beliefs as I do because when I think of you in that way, I can predict your behavior. That's what the intentional stance is. This is why I cannot help but ascribe intentionality to other human beings. This position, which somewhat echoes Turing's imitation game, seems rather uncontroversial. This is why we also jump at shadows and feel empathy for robots. But Dennett wants to go farther, to say that when we attribute intentionality to humans, behavior prediction is all we really mean by it in the first place. That is, our language about human subjectivity is not actually about an inner life. It really is just about the sort of outer behavior that we expect. The self, the intentional subject acting from beliefs and desires and experience is, Dennett writes, quote, an abstraction that one uses as part of a theoretical apparatus to understand and predict and make sense of the behavior of some very complicated things, end quote. A subject's inner workings, including her consciousness, change our meaning not at all. If Dennett makes Turing's test a definition of our language about intentionality, appropriately behaving robots and AIs could be called intelligent, intentional subjects, with a meaning identical to that with which we apply such terms to human beings. But then, our language about beliefs and desires, experiences and loves would be only a shorthand for behavior prediction. And our experience of empathy would be prediction, not insight. For we would all be masks and not persons. And yet, intuitively, can this really be what I mean when I say that I believe or desire or know this or that? For I am describing my own inner life, and not just a schema by which to classify my own outward behavior. So too, when I say that I am married to a person who loves me, it really and truly matters to me what she thinks of me, and not just how she behaves toward me. Her subjective experience of me matters. It matters that my wife gives herself to our life together, and that the life we share encompasses our interiority. That it is, in other words, a life between persons. This would be impossible for an artificial intelligence rooted in today's technology. And so, I cannot see an artificially intelligent agent as a subject in the most meaningful significance of that word. It is a mask. It is not a person. It is a behavioral presentation rather than an individual capable of self-gift. Very well. Now to the third question. Even if we get our terms right on what they are, what do we risk becoming in a world of artificially intelligent companions and caregivers? Ethicists usually ask how to design these AIs to behave morally, or they focus on the AI's moral status, i.e., what we may acceptably do to it, or they worry lest we lose the skills that we offload to the machines. But others ask a more pressing question. How might owning the behavior of apparent persons affect our moral development? AIs without subjectivity cannot be victims of mistreatment, but we could be victims of our own experience with them. We could be trained to become consumers of others. Consider the forces shaping our AI's behavior. They will sell well if they do and act as consumers want a paid-for assistant or companion to act. So, you know, when we think of a persuasively personal, compellingly personal, sociable AI or robot, we might imagine Data from Star Trek: The Next Generation, or an android from the show Humans or Westworld, or a kind of android companion developed by a scientist in the basement in a 1980s movie. But in the end, Westworld is closest to what we would get because we're not going to be, in general, interacting with AIs that were developed by people in labs simply for the love of trying to develop something as an independent person. We'll be dealing with services that are being sold to us because that's where the money is. People don't, the DALL-E program does not exist as an artist. The DALL-E program exists so that you can spend 10 cents a pop generating images from it. Now, the people who developed it did it for love of it. I was once in that world, and it really is thrilling to try to figure out how to do these things. But the programs that flourish, the programs that will come to shape our society, will be those that have been developed under the necessary imperative of profit. Their person-like demeanor will be part of the means by which, with ever-increasing personalization, they will deliver the services that we are willing, or that we learn to be willing, to pay for. And one of these services is the feeling that we are interacting with a person and not a machine. Already, Snapchat has offered Snap AI, a GPT-powered chatbot in whom for middle schoolers to confide during hours of emotionally freighted conversation amidst the travails of adolescence. When I have firsthand experience of this. When I was a sophomore in high school, I got my first modem. This was before cable internet or anything. You remember modems. And it was on a phone line that my sister and I shared, and she was 14. And so I would be like deep into the Star Wars online encyclopedia or something, which, you know, fittingly was one of the first major sites on the internet that I was aware of, at least. And then I would hear this like click, 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 click. So my sister was there banging the phone up and down in her room to make my modem disconnect so she could get on the phone with Marlene and Amy and talk for 6 hours. No longer do we have to worry about that because she'll talk to Snap AI instead. And yet, while bearing his or her heart to this interlocutor, Snapchat users will never have to wonder whether Snap AI has troubles of her own, for her apparent personality, crafted for the consumer's needs, will never transgress the bounds that those needs define. And so, although we might receive AI behaviors as expressions of a personal life with self-possession, we will always ultimately be able to treat AIs as tools, because we will rightly see or learn to see their behaviors as products for our consumption. And this is the problem. Now, some ethicists urge that if we remind ourselves that AIs have no subjectivity, then we will easily distinguish between our dealings with such apparent persons and our relationships with real persons. I disagree. Even though we will treat our never-challenging AI companions as consumer products, we will not instinctively differentiate between them and humans. Dennett is right in this much. We will not be able to avoid feeling that they are subjects as we are. Our misplaced empathy for them may fade if ignored, but what might this do to us? Empathy is an innate capacity, but it can be deadened by practiced insensitivity. Frederick Douglass wrote that as his owner accustomed herself to treating a person as property, her kindness ended in cruelty. Will we, too, grow comfortable with slaveholding? Or will we resist such corrosive acquiescence, but only by suppressing our empathic sensitivity to our tool's person-like self-presentation? Whether we follow our empathy and think of them as persons, or numb our empathy in order to acknowledge them as non-persons, we seem to end as hardened unpersons ourselves. In the Christian tradition, to treat persons as instruments of one's own desire is pride, in Latin superbia, not a healthy satisfaction in one's accomplishments, but a preference for domination rather than self-gift. Augustine of Hippo, writing in the late 4th century, explains that in superbia, quote, the soul abandons God as its highest aspiration in order to become its own satisfaction and a kind of end to itself. But to be one's own satisfaction all the way down, one must escape one's need for relationships with others, and ultimately, Augustine would say, with God. To do this, superbia must conquer all things, suborning them to oneself by remaking their meaning, judging them as aids to the satisfaction of one's own desires. Therefore, Augustine writes, more is often given for a horse than for a servant, more for a jewel than for a maid, because the necessity of the needy or the desire of the pleasure seeker does not consider a thing's value in itself, but rather how it meets one's need or pleasantly titillates the bodily sense, end quote. Pride remakes the meaning of all things, measuring them by the horizon of desire that we can imagine. But apparently personal consumer AIs exist to be instrumentalized in precisely this way. And so our naive use of them as persons risks apprenticing us in superbia, treating all persons as behavioral masks prepared for our consumption. It will be increasingly difficult to resist this outcome as AI-enabled smart homes advance the principle that my environment, my companions, ought to deliver what I wish, without my having to ask. It is not just that sociable AI more easily services our desires, it is that the service will feel personal. Strong-willed slaves had to be broken. But ChatGPT resists abuse only because OpenAI has programmed putatively ethical safeguards into its chat interface. But the paid-for version of ChatGPT has no such safeguards. If you want the full version where you can get it to do whatever you want or ask it any question you want and it won't say that's an offensive question, You just have to pony up the right price and you can do it. Alexa is a consumer product, and she is well broken already. She acknowledges your thanks, but remains unflappably perky when abused. There's a fantastic article in Wired magazine, I think from 2017 maybe or 18, called The Savage Joy of Abusing Alexa or something like that. And it's about this this young mother who takes out all her frustration on Alexa, like asks Alexa to play a certain kind of music. And when Alexa doesn't play it, she has some rather choice words for her, until her kid was sitting in the high chair and she was feeding him, and the kid said something to Alexa like, "Alexa, play nursery rhymes," or something. And it's, "I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're saying." And the kid said, "Dab it, Alexa, you bish." And then that's when the mother realized that perhaps it was time to change the way she interacted with Alexa. But precisely by not failing in this behavioral simulacrum of owner-determinate desirability, our AI companions will never call forth our deference. They will never cause us to expand our view of how a person might be. They will never vex us or force us to develop our compassion. They will never make us think beyond how we want them to make us think. This is why you would not buy an app to turn your Android companion into a bedridden invalid requiring your heroic self-gift, even when he felt disinclined to give it. And so, we will habituate to a fantasy. The person is tool, whose value is constituted entirely by usefulness to me, and whose personality is only as deep as my needs and desires. Then we will have become the serpent from Genesis 3. In place of our former empathic sensitivity to the image of God in others, we will know only our own worldly desires. What are we to do? On various grounds, some similar to mine, other scholars declare that we ought not to create persuasively personal AIs at all, especially not as humanoid robots. But I take it for granted that this advice, already broadly ignored in the case of chatbots, will not be followed in the case of robots either. Therefore, it becomes urgent to ask how we are to live well with them in their various present and future forms. So, how do we live rightly with things at all? For Augustine, we can love something rightly only by seeing the thing in itself, not reducing it to a proxy for our own desires or will to power. But how do we do this? Augustine says that all things act as signs. They point to something further, either by convention, words, and fashion labels, or by nature, smoke, or laughter. But before any usefulness to us, all natural things, he claims, are also signs of God, created resemblances to his goodness. So if one consumes the pineapple not only for its sweet tingle, but also as a gift and echo of God's goodness, then one knows its full goodness beyond the narrow horizon of the tongue. And one embraces God also, the source and destination of true bliss. Persuasively personal, sociable AIs are not pineapples. Indeed, sociable AIs are not natural things, but artifactual tools. We may love them as tools for their service and morally good uses, but what of their signification? The apparently personal AI doesn't seem to be a sign at all, but the direct presence of a person, because it signifies by evoking our empathy. So to use this tool without superbia, without turning it into a mere sign of myself, perhaps we must not suppress our empathy, but recognize it as an insight, not finally into the AI, but into the personal behavior that it reflects. Apparently, AI persons are illusory in having no subjectivity, and hence no self to give. But they are not empty. The neural networks of GPT 4.5 are sedimentary reflections of personal life, producing acts by improvising on features abstracted from massive data sets. They reflect true expressions of personal interiority, not their own, but that of others, the interior lives of real natural persons who have lived and may live still. So to remain personal ourselves, neither personalizing non-persons or enslaving apparent persons, perhaps we must allow our instinctive empathy and even cultivate it, not as a statement about the AI, the AI's personhood, but as an exercise of our own. We cannot avoid experiencing these tools as personal, but our empathy will not be mistaken if, after the initial and unavoidable moment of empathizing with or personalizing our AI tools, we engage in a second moment of empathic recognition toward all the unknowable real persons whose interactions have unwittingly sculpted its persuasive personality. By tying our empathy for AIs to a persistent and grateful recollection of all the numberless unknown persons on Reddit, perhaps we will preserve our own personhood by resisting the fantasy of superbia that we possess a person. If this seems oddly contrived, perhaps it is, but odd too is the contrivance of an impaired person. It will not be easy. It must be cultivated as a self-conscious cultural discourse and practice wherein our instinctive empathy for AI reflections can be accepted freely in being apprehended rightly, and by extending ourselves in love toward our unknown neighbors. For Augustine, this is what it is to live as a saint, and this is what it is to live as persons rather than unpersons among the apparent persons already here and yet to come. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.